The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate. Ma Kashyapa and a flagpole, the main case. Ananda once said to Ma Kashyapa, "The world honor one transmitted to you the brocade robe. What else did he transmit to you?" Ma Kashyapa called out, "Ananda." Ananda answered, "Yes." Ma Kashyapa said, "Pull down the flagpole at the gate." Woman's commentary. If you can give the exact turning word to this koan, you'll see that the meeting of Mount Kurukshetra is definitely present here. If not, then know that Vipassana Buddha is still unable to get the truth, even though he began his seeking in remote antiquity. Woman's poem. The calling out is good, but even better the answering. How many are there who have opened their true eyes? The elder calling out, the younger replying, the family shame is revealed. This is the spring that does not belong to yin and yang. Happy solstice. And this morning, did you feel off balance as the world shifted its direction? It always seemed like this should be not only the shortest, but the coldest day of the year, but it doesn't quite work out like that. I hadn't presented this koan in a long time, but I wanted to say a little bit about Hojin Sensei's ascending to the abbot seat yesterday at the temple. Because of the space limitation down there, a lot of people who would like to have been there weren't able to attend. The temple, you know, when we began in 1980, before I was here, from the very beginning, there was a presence in New York of students and Sangha members who came up here to practice, but also were developing, you know, a sitting group down there. So for a number of years, we would rented spaces in different places, and then had a kind of a well-established place on 26th Street on the west side where we were there for a few years. It was commercial space, a loft. It kept getting more and more expensive. And at a certain point, Myotai Sensei, who was the active teacher there, thought that we should leave Manhattan and look for a place elsewhere that was more permanent. And she located this fabulous place in Burham Hill, in Brooklyn. And so that was established. We purchased that in 2000. And so she, as the acting teacher, began to establish a more permanent place of training, the temple, Fire Lotus Temple, and did a tremendous job at helping to sort of guide and develop that sangha there. And that was at a time where, you know, going from Manhattan to Brooklyn was a little bit tricky. We didn't know if people would cross the river and come. Brooklyn at that point wasn't quite as cool as it is now, so it didn't have quite the draw. we'd never be able to afford the place now with what's going on there. And then she, up to that point, Dada Roshi was really the acting abbot there, even though he would go down and teach and do retreats, but he had overall sort of a, you know, responsibility for the temple, but Myotai Sensei was really the one who was running things. And then in 2003, she did ascending the mountain. So every temple in the Zen tradition is associated with a mountain, either literally, as we are with our very fortunate mountain here, or even within cities, there's always the temple is really regarded as sort of being a mountain in itself and having a mountain spirit, you might say. And it also has a mountain name. So our mountain name is Tenkozan, Heavenly Light Mountain. Doshinji is our temple name, the Way of Reality Temple. In the temple, in the city, Taito-san is the temple, is a mountain name, which means a peaceful way mountain. And Karenji is the temple name, Fire Lotus Temple. And so there's a ceremony where a person ascends the mountain opens the hall, becomes the new abbot, which means the previous abbot needs to step down to vacate that seat. And so so she did that in 2003, and then when she departed a year or so later to teach independently, I went down. Dato Roshi asked me to go down and just take care of things and offer teachings down there. And he sort of resumed that role of being abbot during that time. And then when I needed to come back here, Hojin Sensei and Hogen Sensei led, co-taught there for a number of years and took care of things. And then when COVID hit and some things changed in Hogen Sensei's life, so Hojin Sensei really needed to be the primary teacher there. So I asked her if she would do that, and she's been doing a really marvelous job of leading and teaching and just helping to cultivate a very vibrant temple and city sangha there. So yesterday we did this formal ceremony where I descended the mountain, and she, as the acting abbot, ascended and took her seat as the abbot there. And of course the abbot, she told the story that when she asked me a few months ago, you know, what does this mean that she's becoming the abbot? How does it change things? And she recounted that I told her, it means the target is now on your back. or the target that's already been there just got larger, you could say. but the abbot in the Zen tradition, you know, it's a word that we borrow from the Western monastic tradition, is, you know, has overall responsibility for the leadership and the teaching of that community, both administratively and dharma-wise. And so it's their responsibility to try and have a vision and guide and lead forth, sort of lead forward the Sangha in the direction that seems most skillful and necessary and appropriate. And so in a way, you know, when I came here and I began studying with Dato Roshi, I wasn't thinking or aware of it, but in a way I entered into training and practicing and studying with him as my teacher, but also entering into his vision of how to build a temple, how to build a monastery, how to train monastics and laity, how to develop this dharma in a way that it was very intimately tied to the tradition, going back to the Buddha, and at the same time was responsive to the needs of today's practitioners and how to hold that balance or that tension. And so the abbot's job is really to have a very present-day, immediate sort of fingers on the pulse of the Sangha every day, because as I often say, you know, the Sangha, a monastery, is not a thing that exists somewhere. It's a living thing. We create it every day. And we create it with the sincerity and the vibrancy and the vitality to which we bring ourselves to practice. So the abbot needs to have their, and she's choosing to use that term rather than abbess, really has their fingers on the pulse so that the day-to-day training can be responsive to what is needed in terms of what's going on here, what's going on in a larger sense, but also have a long view, a larger vision. So, you know, Dato Roshi was thinking of next generations, and he was thinking of us while he was still very much alive, and he was thinking of us when he would not be alive. So he really was thinking forward and helping to do everything that needed to happen today for today, but also for tomorrow. And it took a long time for me to really appreciate that view, that vision that he was holding, because so much of it needed to be obviously internalized within him. You know, he couldn't, nobody really has that view. And so that's part of the deal. And in a monastery, everybody, or in a training center, temple, everybody has a place. That's really important to understand. Those of you who might have just come today for the first time, people who come for retreats, those of you who come every Sunday or many Sundays, residents, short-term residents, long-term residents, monastics, teachers, seniors, people serving on the board, with the ethics committee, with the Sangha Harmony advisory council, all of these different groups within affinity groups, everybody in the Sangha has a role to play. For the most part, people are, you know, most Sangha members are just aware of their practice and how that works within this larger living thing. But each person is really fulfilling a role, a very important role that makes all of this possible. And all of that comes down and relies upon what we call practice, which is a word that is perfect in many ways to what is necessary to develop ourselves in the Dharma, because it's something that we have to do and do and do and do. But it also is much more inclusive. It holds much more. When I say that everything comes down to and relies upon practice, that includes everything. It's the essence of our reason for being here. It's the lifeblood of the Buddha Dharma, to make intimate contact with the real. If in turning towards or seeking the Dharma, in some way we have begun to have a sense that there is something that is not working in our life, and the parallel sense that there is something that could be, both are present. If there wasn't some sense of dukkha, of samsara, why would we go seeking? But if we had an awareness of dukkha and thought, well, there's just nothing that can be done about it, why would we go seeking? So inherent within our seeking, both are present, even if we won't own up to it, you know, or we don't have faith in ourselves, is what I mean. But that might be very incipient. It might be very, very shy or dim to us. It's got to be there. And so through our practice with the precepts and the paramitas and our meditation and working with our thoughts and our emotions and our history, our karma and the karma consequences, all of that is in service to freeing ourselves. I remember a very sort of discouraged student many years ago who was working on Mu, the first koan, finally came to the profound, had an epiphany that the koan is really, there is no koan, there is no mood, there's nothing to see. Nobody ever enlightens himself. It's really just a way of keeping people busy. I said, really? That's what you think? Wow. There's so many other easier ways to be kept busy, right? Everything. And all of those different things are having direct influence and impact on our lives. They're helping, each in their own way, and they're all a part of a whole that is working together. We call it the Eightfold Path, that is working together in concert, in the kind of exquisite tuning that is bringing ourselves into accord with the real, things as they are. Dogen said, to be freed from one's body and mind and those of others. But how does that come to fruition? How can that be spoken of, something ineffable? And so one day, Ananda, who is the attendant, long-time attendant of the Buddha, asked the Buddhas in our lineage, in the Zen tradition, Mahakashyapa is the second ancestor. So it said that the Buddha transmitted the Dharma to Mahakashyapa. This is the Zen sort of perspective on things. And then Mahakashyapa transmitted to Ananda, and so on the lineage traveled. And so here the Buddha has transmitted the Dharma to, so this is a non-historical moment, right? Which doesn't matter. It doesn't in any way diminish the power of this koan, because the koan is not about reliving history, but it's about liberating ourselves. And so Mahakashyapa said, when the Buddha transmitted to you, he gave you a robe, a kesa, which is one of the objects of transmission, to signify that the transmission mind to mind has taken place. But what else did he give you? What else did you get? What else happened? So he's thinking something else must have happened. He didn't just give you a robe. And so Ananda, my Kashyapa calls out Ananda, and Ananda says, yes. My Kashyapa says, pull down the flagpole. So that represents that when a talk, there are a couple different interpretations, when a talk is being given, such as today, a banner would be run up a flagpole to announce that a talk was being prepared to be given. At the end of the talk, it would be taken down. So my Kashyapa calls out Ananda, and Ananda says, yes. And Kashyapa says, take down the flag. Taisho is finished, completed. Actually, he says, take the whole thing down. Another interpretation is that when two people were debating, or two teachers, for instance, were debating the Dharma, they would both put up a banner. And whoever won the debate got to keep their banner up, but the other person had to take theirs down to declare the winner. But here, Kasho is saying, take them all down. No winner. No one left standing. So what's being communicated? What is happening here? Another translation says that my Kashyapa said, the flag announcing my Dharma talk, go tear it down, pole and all. Take it all down. So what else was passed on beside the robe? My Kashyapa says, Ananda, it's like an arrow being shot out, piercing the heavens. Ananda answers, yes, before knowing there is no one. Shibhayama, commenting on this, says, Kasho calls Kasho. Ananda answers Ananda. The whole universe is Kasho who is calling. The whole universe is Ananda who is answering. Kasho calls Ananda, and Ananda answers Kasho. The universe calls and the universe answers. Can there be more intimate calling and answering than this? And then he says, I'm afraid I've said too much. For I have once expressed in words, it has already been tainted and comes to be the reality itself no longer. It can only be experienced and testified to personally by oneself. That's why we sit on this cushion, to go deep into that intimate contact. We might think that as the mind becomes more and more clear, that at some point it sees itself. But the teachings say in various ways, an eye cannot see itself. A knife cannot cut itself. So it's not so. Rather, the original mind, which is so bright and clear, eventually frees one's body and mind and those of others. Or more accurately, that bright and clear Buddha mind reveals that body and mind and those of others have been freed from the beginning. So in a very real sense, delusion or samsara in Buddhism, the illness is our conviction, our belief, our faith, and in fact, our dedication to having an illness, to believing that there is an illness. But calling and answering happens all the time. A parent calls their child. A friend calls to their friend. The Doksan bell rings. The student gets up and moves quickly to the Doksan room. Is this not calling and answering? Well, then why isn't everybody realizing Buddha mind? Why isn't the Taisho ceaselessly finding its conclusion? One of the things that makes this koan significant, or one of the aspects of it, sort of inside of it, is that Ananda, it was an historical person, right? These are real people. Ananda was a cousin, the cousin of the Buddha, was born evidently on the same day. So they grew up together, playmates, cousins. And so they shared the same birthday. And then Ananda entered, the Buddha left home at, I think, age 29. Ananda entered the homeless life as a monk at age 37. And there's quite a bit written about Ananda, actually. And he features quite a bit in the sutras. He was considered a great teacher by the Buddha. He attended the Buddha for many, many years. And there's a recounting of how that took place, that when the Buddha was... I have that somewhere else. When the Buddha was 55, they were both 55, the Buddha called together his students and said, you know, over the years I've had many attendants. So it's customary for a teacher to have an attendant. And in our tradition, the attendant really has very light lifting, I would say. Traditionally, the attendant basically lives sort of and sort of gives up their life and their service for the teacher and is there to provide whatever the teacher is needed and is needing and as they continue their own practice. And so the Buddha called everybody together and said, look, over the years I've had lots of different attendants. None of them were actually that good. None of them were really taken care of very well. So I'd like to have a new attendant. So who would like to do that? So of course everybody raised their hand and the Buddha didn't acknowledge any of them. The only person that didn't raise their hand was Ananda. And so everybody turns to Ananda and says, what about you? And so, and it said that Ananda, when asked why he was the only one who didn't volunteer, because he would very much like to be the Buddha's attendant, he said he had so much confidence in the Buddha that he thought the Buddha already knows who should be his attendant. So why should I even, because he already knows. So it didn't even occur to him to express his own desire to be the attendant, even though he would have liked to. Then the Buddha said, well, it would please him very much for the Ananda to be his attendant. And so Ananda said he would very much like to accept that, but he had 8 conditions. But listen to the conditions. He said the first is that the Buddha should never pass a gift of robes on to him. So if he received a gift of robes, that he should never, if the Buddha didn't want them, he should never give them to Ananda. Second, that he should never give the Buddha should never give Ananda food that he himself had received when he was on his begging rounds. If he had too much to eat, he should give it to somebody else, but not him. Third, having received a dwelling place, the Buddha, he should never give it to Ananda. And fourth, that he should never include Ananda in any personal invitation, such as an occasion for teaching the Dharma where a meal would be offered. The other 4 were requests. He says if he was invited to a meal, he asked the right to transfer this invitation to the Buddha. So rather than him going, that he would ask the Buddha to go instead. That if people from other outlying areas came and asked for the privilege to, that Ananda wanted the privilege to introduce them to the Buddha. So he wanted to be able to be a conduit between those people and the Buddha. That if Ananda had any doubts or inquiries about the Dharma, that the Buddha would agree to allow Ananda to come and ask for clarification at any time. And that if for any reason that Ananda was not there when the Buddha was teaching, that he asked, and this to me is a big one, he asked that the Buddha would repeat that teaching to Ananda privately so he would not miss any teaching. Some of the Buddha's teachings were kind of long. So, and the Buddha said he would abide by all of those. And it was clear that Ananda didn't want anybody to think that he was taking this role for any personal gain. And so to make that very clear, he forsook any of those privileges we might think of that might become points of doubt in any of the Sangha's mind. There are also some instances where he was criticized, sometimes by his own elders, for various things that he did that were not appropriate. And in the sutras, he's always being presented as responding very humbly, taking responsibility, doing whatever needed to be done. He's portrayed as being very kind and compassionate. He's like the person that everybody loved. And then, of course, one of his most significant events or actions in the time of the Buddha was his role in facilitating the admittance of women into the order. So most of you know the story that Mahapajapati, who was represented on the altar to the Buddha's right, came with 500 other women who were all wanting to leave home. and asking to be ordained. And the Buddha said in response, do not, and remember that Mahapajapati raised the Buddha. She was his aunt who is, because the Buddha's mother died very soon after childbirth. So she raised him as her own child. And so she came to the Buddha and asked for ordination. And the Buddha said, do not be eager, Gotami, to obtain the going forth of women from home into homelessness in the Dharma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata. So it's interesting in this wording, he doesn't say no, he says, do not be eager. Do not be eager. But this was taken as basically a negation. He did not open that door. She asked three times, he said the same thing each time. Then the Buddha traveled to some distant place, and Mahapajapati and all of the other women traveled with, followed them, and came again and made another appeal. And the Buddha responded in the same way. And it was at this point that Ananda, seeing Mahapajapati distraught and unhappy, and asked him, what's going on? Because remember, he's known her his whole life. And she explained what had happened. So he goes to the Buddha and says, like, what's up? <You know? clears throat> And then he's very skillful. He said, is it true that women can attain enlightenment? The Buddha had made that clear from the very beginning. In fact, so clear that he said his mission in this lifetime would not be complete until he had lay and ordained male and women, men and women in the community, in the Sangha. So up to that point, he had everyone except the women ordained. And so he had already foretold that this had to happen before he could depart his life. So why did he hesitate? Why did he say, do not be eager? So modern scholars have been asking this question for some years, trying to really understand, why would he have said this? Why would he have made it difficult? And not only difficult, but when he admitted women, he did it under the caveat that they had to take on 8 special rules. And the monastics lived at that time and still within their Theravada tradition under many, many very specific monastic rules that govern basically every aspect of their life. But the Buddha gave additional rules to the women that were very clearly putting them in a second-class status and subjugating them to the male ordained. Even one of them was that even a young ordained monk who is ordained today is senior and must be regarded as senior to a very mature ordained woman. So they were very clearly putting them in a sort of a second-class status. So they were called heavy rules. And in Wendy Garland's book, which is wonderful, on the woman who raised the Buddha, which is really about Mahapajapati, she talks about this at some length. What was the Buddha's intention in creating these rules? First, in delaying and sort of creating some obstacle to ordaining the women, but then these special rules. She says, did he really stipulate these additional rules in the first place? Evidence found in this author's investigation of early narratives finds their sexist nature completely out of character for the Buddha and supports many contemporary views that they are of doubtful authenticity. So one of the theories is that they were either altered or introduced later after the Buddha died when the Buddha wasn't there to refute them. And so one scholar said it seems safe to conclude that the elements in the canonical accounts that express a negative attitude towards nuns seem to stem from a later textual layer. In other words, things that were added in later. Pushback, right? From more conservative elements that maybe originally were not so happy about women being ordained, being in a very patriarchal, sexist, misogynistic culture. And then now that the Buddha wasn't there, being able to inject those. So that's a theory. There's no definitive answer to this. So that's one possibility. Another is that, and that I think seems quite viable, is that the Buddha introduced these rules actually as protective rules. You know, one of the things was the Buddha, the Sangha had to be seen favorably by the communities that they traveled amidst, because they were reliant upon those communities for their support. And what the Buddha did here had never been done before. There were other communities of wandering mendicants, but they were all male. They never included both male and men and women. And so he might have been concerned, how is this going to go down, right, in terms of the larger community? And then there was the fact of having women leaving home and wandering across the countryside of India. How would they be kept safe? How could he ensure, because it was his responsibility, and since he was the first abbot, you might say, before there were even monasteries, how could he ensure that they would be okay, taken care of, right? Before there were monasteries, before there were permanent dwellings. In fact, he made a rule at a certain point that the women shouldn't be in the forest, in the woods, meditating alone, because there were some bad events that happened for women who were, right? And so he said, okay, that's not safe, so let's not do that. So that one theory is that they were to, in a sense, help them, keep them safe. True or not, they had that effect of creating this sort of second-class status that then essentially was preserved, because after the Buddha died, it became very difficult to make changes, right? Who's going to change an original teaching or rule of the Buddha? And so it's a tension that exists within that early tradition of Buddhism down to the present time. So in this, going back to this koan, Ananda sort of represents all of this, but also somebody who heard all of the teachings of the Buddha. He was there for almost every sutra the Buddha ever taught. And he is said to have had this essentially photographic memory, so he would recall all of them. And yet, it's said that even at the Buddha's death, he was not fully realized. And so this koan is, in a sense, taking that up. So here the Buddha, the Ananda, is this tremendous person and monk and teacher even, and yet still is not fully clear. What's that about? So he has all of this knowledge, basically. He could recite the sutras. He could explain them. But what this koan is pointing to, that at the deepest level, this fundamental transformation or realization had not taken place. And so the koan basically presents that. What is that ineffable reality that Maya Kashyapa received? So it points to the fact that words, phrases cannot communicate that, cannot give that. In the commentary, if you give the exact turning word to this koan, you'll see that the meeting at Mount Kurukshetra is definitely present here. This is Vulture Peak in northeast India, one of the places the Buddha really liked to go and teach. And there's actually a little, sort of a little structure in which it was where the Buddha stayed. It's an extraordinary place. I remember when we went on a pilgrimage years ago and we were hiking, it's a long hike and it's uphill. It was not easy. And I'm thinking, why did the Buddha choose this place? It's so hard to get to. And then we got there and I was like, oh, this is why. It's extraordinary. Place. Very small, actually. And so the commentary is saying that Vulture Peak is definitely present right now, here. It's not something that happens somewhere else. We're not seeking to be someone else, to be somewhere else, to be in a different time. That's the versions of samsara. Right? Why me? Why this? Why now? It should be, it could be. Better, something else, something different. How much time do we spend in our mind creating an alternate reality that sometimes is a better reality, but it's not the one we have? In Buddha Dharma, it's always here. It's always here. It's always now. Everything else is either the past, it's gone. It exists only in a memory, which is of questionable authenticity. Or it's in the future, which is clearly not real, hasn't happened yet. And so in Zazen, in practice, being mindful is to bring ourselves where life is actually occurring, to the real. But what is here? What is now? Mahakashapa wanted Ananda to know directly, so he called out, Ananda. And Ananda, without thinking, he wasn't thinking, this is a koan. He wasn't thinking, oh, something special is happening. He had just asked a simple question, what else did the Buddha give you? And Kashyapa called out, Ananda. And he said, yes. Without thinking, without knowing, pure. And Kashyapa says, Tesho's completed. There's nothing more. Another translation for the poem is, how can a question have the kindred intimacy of an answer? The calling out is good, even better the answering. How can a question have the kindred intimacy of an answer? I like that translation. The poem asks this question. What is kindred intimacy? Well, kin is to be of the family, to have an intimate relationship. It's not something outside. A kindred intimacy of the blood, it's not another. We could say everything in practice is leading us to this. Elder calling, younger responding. And then it speaks of the family shame. And this is a way of speaking in the Zen tradition. You can look at it as to speak of it. You know, as soon as the Buddha started talking about dukkha, suffering, like, in a way it brings it out. Right? Because we'd rather not bring it out. We'd rather not be suffering. Right? And so there are lots of ways we have, through aversion, through distracting ourselves, of not really knowing. And so in a way, when we encounter the Dharma and the Dharma presents it to us very directly, again and again and again, it's not that suddenly we start suffering, but rather perhaps we start to really recognize what we're experiencing, what we've been experiencing, what our life is and has been, so that now we can see it. If we don't see it, how can we practice it? And so in a way, the family shame is to bring that out and to begin speaking about something, Buddha mind, Buddha nature, realization, enlightenment, as something, right? Because that's what words do. They turn things into things. They turn living realities into objects. And so way the family shame is to share in this tradition of naming something that's unnameable, pointing to something that has no location. To speak of something that, in a sense, can only be known within ourselves directly. But this family, it's important to recognize, is open to everyone. In fact, before you even came here, you were already in it. When we say sentient beings are numbers, I vow to save them, that means everybody. When we have faith in Buddha nature, that everyone has fundamentally the enlightened mind of the Buddha, that means everyone, in a sense, is already a Buddha. They don't know that. They might not even care. So the family is already established. The Buddha made that very clear in his own enlightenment. It's open to all. So we don't enter by birth. In a sense, we don't enter by coming into a monastery. We don't enter by taking vows or having faith or trust or belief in Buddha Dharma. But all of those can help enormously to bring us into kindred intimacy. And so, in a sense, we have to speak about what it's awkward to speak about. We have to name what is, in essence, the unnameable, to point to something that has no fundamental place. So the image that's used is that as we go seeking and we, you know, in a sense, yearn for that peace, that fulfillment and contentment that we all seek, that it's like sitting by the river, calling out in thirst. It's more like being in the river. It's more like being the river and saying, I'm thirsty.
And so
the elder brother calls, the younger brother responds, this is the spring that does not belong to yin and yang, that it can't ultimately be captured as right or wrong, this or that. You know, when each of us was given beginning instruction in Zazen, and we're taught how to assume this profound posture of the Buddha, it may seem so simple. You've seen it in pictures or images on an altar. We recognize it. But I don't think it's possible for any of us to understand how profound this posture is in and of itself, how it brings us into alignment in ways that maybe take a lifetime to fully reveal and understand. And then we're introduced to our mind and our awareness and the very idea or the reality of the first seeds of mindfulness and breath and this notion of non-attachment, which is not a notion but a living thing, an essential thing. And the revolution has begun. And then that simple encouragement, when something arises, do not judge it. Do not judge it. That's the revolution. Awareness is essential. Mindfulness is essential. But if we continue to judge, we are continuing to turn those wheels of right and wrong, yes and no, I am not, I love you, I hate you, I want to be on top, that may mean you have to be down below, you're on that side, I'm on this side. All of the machinations of all of those functions of division are right there in that first moment of judging. We don't see that in the beginning. It just seems like a simple part of the method. Oh, by the way, don't judge. I think if I want to borrow from the Buddha, teaching of the Buddha, where the Buddha said, if we saw things the way he saw them, that whenever we received a gift, we would always want to give it away before we took it for ourselves. And I think if we saw things the way the Buddha realized them to be, we would understand how profoundly important that not judging is. It seems so simple. And it's so habitual. It's so impulsive, right? It seems so true and necessary to judge. And that Zazen is really this invitation to give that a rest. And just see what happens. What happens in your mind? Mind meaning your whole everything. When that really begins to relax. And not just happen within you, but what begins to change in the world around you, how you see it. There's a springtime beyond the season of yin and yang. May we all awaken that. I'll end with a simple poem. Who suspected, who believed that all along, it was all along? Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.